Leadership File on Premier.
Well, welcome to The Leadership File, your weekly show inspiring you to lead for Christ wherever you are. I'm Andy Peck, your host, thanking you for joining us. And whether you're listening live or one of the many thousands who listen via the podcast, it's great to have you along. If you're new to the show, reminder that the show's available on demand via premierradio.com, via iTunes or Podbean. And my aim with the shows is to provide knowledge, skills and attitudes for a Christian to lead so that God's work is advanced. So do continue to join us, and God helping us, we will flourish in his ways. So to this week, I'm joined by Richard Tiplady, the Director of Mixed Mode Training at Scottish Episcopal Institute. Regular listeners may recall we've spoken at various times over the years of his work as Director of European Christian Mission, as Principal of International Christian College, surrounding its closure and the opening of the Scottish School of Christian Mission, and also with his studies in preparation for a PhD looking at entrepreneurship. But our topic this week is rather more personal. Back on March the 5th, Richard survived a 600-foot fall when climbing in the mountains in the Lake District. His survival was described as miraculous by a national daily newspaper. And I thought it'd be interesting to hear the story and what leadership lessons he might have learned from the experience. So, Richard, great to have you along.
Hi, Andy. It's lovely to talk to you again.
And great to be speaking to you at all, of course, given what's happened. So, first of all, you're a keen climber. How long have you been climbing, and how did you get into it?
I suppose most of my life I've had some engagement with mountains. I was 21 when I walked around Derwent Water, but I did it on the mountaintops rather than around the lake over a couple of days. Just circumnavigated the whole of Derwent Water from hilltop to hilltop. And for much of my life, with a couple of my best friends, once a year we'll go and spend a couple of days in the Pennines or in the Lake District. So it's been a little thing for a long time. But then about 4 years ago, it became a bigger thing. I don't think it was only because I turned 50. I developed a chronic pain condition that I was told and discovered that brisk walking would help to relieve, and it did. And it didn't take long before I went from brisk walking around the nature reserve on the edge of my village to climbing some of the local hills, to then realizing that here in Scotland we've got 282 Munros in over 3,000 feet. You know, there are three in England, there are 14 in Wales, and there are 282 in Scotland. And I discovered the joy and pleasure of beginning to use the terminology, to bag the Munros, to begin to climb them. And so in the last 4 years, I've climbed 112 different Munros in Scotland, some of them several times. And it's become, I suppose, a thing. It's been great for exercise and for health and fitness. But what's sometimes not often appreciated is there is, in the mountaineering community, a recognition that there is a spiritual dimension to this. I could say it's slightly tongue-in-cheek, in the sense that, you know, Jesus gave his most famous sermon on a mountain, Moses encountered God on a mountain, but there is something about mountains that the mountaineering community will acknowledge to be spiritual.
Right.
And I've certainly found that as a Christian myself, and it's been interesting to think that one through a bit as well from a Christian point of view. Mm-hmm. Mainly, a lot of the writing and said about this tends to come from a slightly Buddhist perspective and sense of sensing one's oneness with the mountains. But as a Christian, it's more about, if you like, encountering the creation that God has made. And also, I think I would call it something of a spiritual discipline.
Mm. Fabulous. Well, take us back to March the 5th.
Yes. So there was, as I say, something of a spiritual discipline even to that day. So there's a chap who lives in the Lake District called John Fleetwood, who's developed this idea of mountain pilgrimage. He refers to particularly certain mountains as, he calls them nature's cathedrals, you know, with soaring spires, and they encourage us to look upwards. And he, like me, is quite keen that we can engage with fellow mountaineers, but from a Christian perspective, and say, let's think not just about the mountains, but the God who made them. And so he has this idea of pilgrimage into the mountains. And I was keen to find out more from a personal point of view, but also from what I might be able to do then up here, where there's obviously a very large mountaineering community. So we'd never met. We had a lot of mutual friends, but it doesn't take much if you're into mountaineering. If someone contacts you out of the blue and says, do you fancy a day on the hills? It's like, yeah, okay. So we met. It was the first decent day for a month. We'd had a lot of snow in, and rain and bad weather and high winds through the whole of February. But it was a great morning. And we went together to climb a mountain called Pillar Mountain in the Lake District, which is so called because about three quarters of the way up, there was a very large rock pinnacle, a pillar sticking out. So we climbed up and over one pass and down into another valley and then climbed up to the pillar. He's got some quite interesting liturgy, some poems, quite reflective pieces. It was just a good day, just a really interesting day. Got on well, having a good time. And as I say, it's quite a long way up the mountain, is this rock pillar, which is, and the mountain is a fairly big one. It's just shy of 3,000 feet, so it's fairly tall. And we came to the question of, okay, that's been good. We've had a good day. It's early afternoon. Do we head back or shall we, we're most of the way up, we might as well finish the hill. You know, that hadn't been the plan. It had been to go to the rock pillar, but we may as well finish the hill. It's only another 150 metres of summit. We're in the snow, lots of very firm, frozen snow. We've got crampons, ice picks. We're well equipped for winter. And it's a nice, clear ridgeline up to the summit, which is usually the safest way to go. So off we went. We got very close to the summit, and right at the summit there is a substantial rocky outcrop. It's only about 10 metres, but it's the final bit. And straight up was a particularly dodgy-looking ice-filled gully that John, who is a very, very skilled mountaineer, was perfectly happy with. I consider myself a reasonably experienced amateur now. And I just thought, I'm not sure that's... it looks a bit sketchy. There was a route round to the right that looked a bit more straightforward, so I thought I would take that, and we just agreed we'd meet at the top in 5 minutes. That's what it would take, 5-10 minutes. So I went round, and I came to another decision point where the route I was on began to get quite slopey and again a bit risky, but I noticed another straight route up, which I went to investigate, and then halfway up realised that again there was quite a big icy step that was just a bit tricky and a bit risky. And somewhat ironically, given what happened, I mean, one always thinks about risk management in these circumstances and what's safe and being careful. No one goes out to have an accident. And I thought, yeah, this is a bit difficult. I'll go back and look at the other route again. I'll go back down. And it was only probably a 2-3 meter descent back to the level, to the path. It wasn't level, but to the path. Covered in frozen snow, rocks sticking out. As I descended, and descending is always the dangerous bit, and as I descended, that's where I slipped. I can't exactly remember why, that bit is a bit of a blur, but I slipped and immediately found myself sliding down a very steep, rocky, snowy slope. There is a process of what's called self-arrest using an ice axe, where you have the axe under your body and you press the pick of the axe into the snow and it acts as a brake. And I was in that position and I was starting to do that, and I could feel the pick beginning to bite, but very quickly, unfortunately, I hit a rock which knocked me out of position, and then I hit another rock which knocked the ice out of my hands, and before I knew it, I was sliding downhill very quickly with no means of stopping myself, and dropped into quite a steep snow-filled rocky gully. I've described it as a toboggan run with added rocks. And I was descending at considerable speed. What was interesting about the experience, both at the time and afterwards, is I realised I had absolutely no panic, and just how focused I was on the situation. You're very aware that this is a problem. You are in a very problematic situation, and in those scenarios, really, there's only two things you can do. Because you're not going to be able to stop yourself. You're probably sliding. It's amazing how quickly you go. You're probably going 30, 40, 50 kilometres an hour very quickly. And on frozen snow, that's you're not going to stop yourself. You're going to be stopped by hitting something, and normally that will be rock. So in the circumstances, the first thing you do is you make sure you stay feet first. And I was head first on at least one occasion.
Oh, so gracious. Wow.
But there are techniques of putting one arm down on one side that will slow you down slightly, a little bit of friction that will turn you so you can get yourself feet first again, because your legs are a crumple zone in a way that your head isn't. So you know you're going to hit something, but you want to hit with your legs, because if you come out with it with a broken leg, then, you know, that's a good outcome.
Yeah.
The second thing is, you're not going to stop yourself, but you can slow yourself down a bit by pressing your arms firmly into the ground, you know, like putting both arms out and pressing it down, because there's a difference between hitting something at 30k and 50k, so you might as well try and slow down a bit.
Yeah.
But other than that, there's not much you can do. And it, I was aware that I was sighting for quite a long time. I mean, people have asked me how long it was, and it's very hard to try and calculate it, probably something in the region of 20 seconds, which is quite a long time when you're sliding past.
Gracious, yes.
And all of a sudden, to my surprise, I realised that I was hitting stuff, and then I had stopped. And I was lying down, face up, which is interesting, because you try and go face down to keep your feet off the ground, because you've got crampons on. You don't want those to touch the ground, because then you'll tumble. But I realised that I had been clattering my way through the debris of an avalanche, and an avalanche is not made up of fluffy snow. It's made up of large football and bigger sized ice, you know, snowballs, rock solid, that were very firmly bonded into the ground, but basically had given me friction. I had smashed my way through quite a lot of this, but as I'd done it, it had slowed me down, and it brought me to a stop about 20 to 30 feet before a 200-foot precipice. But I was alive, and
wow.
I was secure. So at that point, then it's a case of assessing your circumstances and then beginning to work out how to get rescued. So the first thing is, am I secure? Yes, the ground is incredibly firm, the snow is incredibly firm. Both my feet, my crampon boots, are firmly planted on one of these very large, you know, football-sized or bigger snowballs. I've got almost one under each arm. It's almost like I'm in an armchair, really. I'm lying back. I'm not in danger of falling forward. So the ground is firm. I noticed over to my left, about 5 meters away, was a level bit of rocky, flat ground that was clear, but to get to it would have been difficult because the snow slope between me and there was not covered by the avalanche debris. It was very smooth, and I just thought, I'm not going to take the risk. Then you've got to assess your injuries. I was bleeding very heavily. I had 3 deep wounds to my head. It took over 60 stitches to heal or to fix. Blood dripping off my nose. One eye is completely closed because of the blood. I realised that my right ankle is extremely sore, and I've probably broken that, and my entire left arm is in agony. I can barely lift it. So it turned out I'd broken my elbow. I thought I'd broken my shoulder, but it turned out that I'd actually broken my neck, and it had dislodged one of my neck bones, and that was pressing onto my left arm nerve, so the entire left arm was incredibly painful.
Richard, I'm going to have to break in, sadly. It's riveting to hear, but we're coming to an ad break, so we'll... you're listening to The Leadership File with me, Andy Peck, with Richard Tiplady, telling us about this most dramatic fall in the Lake District Mountains. And we'll be back just after this. Welcome back to The Leadership File with me, Andy Peck. I'm joined by Richard Tiplady, who is the Director of Mixed Mode Training at Scottish Episcopal Institute. But he's telling us this story of a journey in the mountains, which had a 600-foot fall attached to us. And he's just, before the break, spoken of the fall and of coming to terms with the injuries and wondering what's going to happen next. So, Richard, carry on with the story, please.
Thank you. So the next thing is, as I say, I've assessed my injuries, is to get help. So I get my phone out. My phone is kept in a zipped pocket in my walking trousers, and it was undamaged. I had a phone signal. There's an app called the OS Locate app, which gives you a very accurate map reference. And I got that so I could say where I was. Dialed 999, asked for police and mountain rescue. That's the standard protocol. Straight through to an operator. I explained what had happened, where I was. that I'd fallen, my injuries, and that I would basically need rescuing, and because of my location, would probably need a helicopter. That was all taken. You can then, in a sense, sit back and relax, because you know that someone is coming to get, someone knows where you are, and someone is coming to get you. I also had a whistle. That's a standard practice, a sort of mountain whistle that you blow. The standard procedure is six blasts. Six short blasts is an emergency call. And the chap I was with obviously didn't know what had happened, because we'd taken slightly different routes at the top. But he heard that whistle and descended down to me. It took him about half an hour to get down to me. And he helped me dress my wounds using the first aid kit. And then we waited. And in about an hour, in total, about an hour after my accident, about half an hour after he got to me, the rescue helicopter turned up.
Wow.
Assessed the situation from distance. You know, the door opened, they observed us. Then they flew off and started ferrying the mountain rescue team up to the top of the mountain. And they abseiled down to me. So about an hour and 20 minutes after my phone call, I am being treated by the mountain rescue team.
Wow.
And my recovery begins, which then led to me being winched off the mountain, taken by the helicopter to Carlisle, to hospital there, and then transferred the next day to Newcastle for 6 days, where I had my an operation to fix my neck, to connect the broken bone to the bone above it by a titanium plate, and to begin the treatment on the broken ankle and broken elbow, and start my recovery. And as I say, have a few head stitches to sort things out as well.
Gracious.
So that's the quick and dirty, as it were, version of the story.
My word. And so, in terms of recovery of parts of your body, you know, what's likely, what's less likely in terms of what you get functioning?
It's what, 2.5 months since it happened. 10 weeks ago, I think it is. The interesting thing about the neck operation, I mean, I was in a neck brace until the operation, but after the operation, I said to the surgeon, "So what's the recovery procedure now? Now the operation's been done." And he said, "Don't drive for 2 weeks." He said, "Your neck's fixed. You know, we've fixed your neck. It's attached to the bone next to it. It's sorted."
Wow.
I was in a moon boot for my ankle for 8 weeks. I broke it on both sides, so my ankle was quite badly broken. And I've got about 3 months of physiotherapy. I'm walking. I mean, I was actually up and walking in hospital. They got me up and about in hospital on crutches. But now I have a lot of physiotherapy. It's pretty painful, I have to be honest.
Sure.
And my left arm weren't quite straightened, but again, I'm having physiotherapy for that. So I'm well on the mend. I'm part-time back at work, like everybody else, part-time back at work from home. It should make a full recovery, and hoping to be back on the mountains sometime.
Well, that was going to be it. You've got some more Munros to climb, for goodness sake, so yes.
there's still another 170 to go, although my target for the year is probably not going to be reached now. But then lockdown's got as much to do with that as my injuries.
Sure.
But I'm planning to be out there again. It's too much fun, too important.
Yeah. Well, I very nervously got in touch with you to see if you were interested in conducting this interview, and you said you'd written an article for Mountain Rescue magazine on the accident and rescue and the kind of things that have struck you and some of the leadership lessons, so maybe we could kind of move to that, and obviously the spiritual dimension to that.
Yes. So I mean, I was interviewed by a number of newspapers and by BBC Radio Scotland and Mountain Rescue magazine, which is the magazine for the mountain rescue teams. I'd written some reflections that, and they'd asked me if I would be willing to share them, and it ended up being published as a 6-page article on lots of things, on what I did right, what went wrong, what I did wrong and need to learn from. Because it's not often someone has that serious an accident and lives to tell the tale.
Absolutely.
And is able to reflect back on to the mountain rescue teams on what was good, what went well, what went wrong. From a personal point of view, I think there are broader lessons here on crisis and crisis management. This was a crisis situation. And I think I want to say something about the importance of preparation. Equipment is important. I had the right gear. You know, I had a first aid kit. I had a survival bag that I climbed into. I was expecting it to take several hours to get rescued. It was incredibly quick. It can normally take 2, 3, 4 hours before a team gets to you because they've got to assemble and travel to you. And you don't want to get cold, so I was in a survival bag. I had the phone. I had the rescue whistle. So there's something about equipment and capacity, having the capacity to deal with things when things go wrong, rather than trying to do everything on by winging it and by sort of just getting away with the bare minimum. There's something about training that I think is quite important. I've done a number of winter mountaineering training courses, and I have a number of books that and booklets and things that I pre-read every year, but particularly before the winter, so that when I was falling, I knew instinctively what to do. I didn't have to consciously think about the things I was doing to try and, you know, stay safe, the keep feet first and slow down thing. It was instinctive.
Right.
And so the importance of training and being trained and ready for anything, well, or ready for when things go wrong, and making sure that training is up to date. And also knowing about what to do when things go wrong, who to call, how do I call them, what are the procedures? I mean, there's a slightly broader lesson here. Forgive me if this sounds a little political, but I think a lot has been said about how the NHS and personal protective equipment and all the issues that we're facing around lockdown, there are questions there about capacity and preparedness. And I think it's true for all of us in leadership. Do we and do our organisations have the capacity and the broader capacity to respond to things when things go wrong and to respond appropriately? So there's some lessons there to my mind. More broadly, the mountain rescue team, the things they did that I think also have some broader relevance is that, firstly, their incredible non-judgmentalism towards someone in distress. I wasn't necessarily sitting there worrying about what they thought about me, but when they turned up, one of the first four guys that got to me, that abseiled down to me and began to treat me, and they belayed me to make sure, put the rope around me and anchored that into the ground to make sure I was safe. But one of the guys said to me, of the four of us here, two of us are on the team because we were rescued by mountain rescue teams. And that hit me really strongly at the time, and still does, because what it said was, we're not judging you. We're all the same here. Sure. We've been in your situation, and that was incredibly powerful at a time when I was obviously somewhat vulnerable and in distress.
Yeah.
And then I think the third thing that struck me incredibly strongly is the teamwork. There were 22 people in the mountain rescue team that came to get me, as well as the four guys in the rescue helicopter. I only saw about five or six of them. Of the team, the people that got to me and treated me and helped me get winched up. There were people at the top who were needed just in case. There were people down at the bottom with the Land Rovers just in case. There was a team of six who started to climb up the mountain from the bottom just in case the helicopter couldn't winch me off and I was going to have to be carried off by a stretcher, and
wow.
They were going to be a relief team. You know, they were a relief team to help the guy on the mountain coming down to take over halfway down. So those six guys, well, guys and girls, I guess they were men and women, started walking up for no reason, if you like, because I was winched off. But someone had to do it just in case.
Yeah.
I was struggling to sit up at one point. That, in a sense, was the first sign, with retrospect, that I'd broken my neck. So one chap just sat behind me and basically acted like a human armchair to hold me up. That's what he did for about an hour, just basically held me up. I get quite moved to talk about that. So the teamwork, the whole 1 Corinthians 12 thing here about body, isn't it? A different route. But they were exemplary in their teamwork, and everyone knew their role and was willing to do it, even if they didn't have, if you like, one of the glory positions, being at the front line, being able to treat the casualty, and they were willing to do it. And I guess the the sacrifice. 22 of them dropped everything, left work at a moment's notice to come and rescue a stranger.
Yeah,
that's quite moving.
Yeah.
So those are the broader lessons, if you like, that I've begun to identify so far from my experience.
Oh, Richard. Well, sadly, time's pretty well defeated us. We've got about a minute left. I mean, obviously, newspapers jump to the word miraculous. How do you look at it in terms of God's providence and activity in the whole thing?
It's interesting, isn't it? Yes, a couple of newspapers use the word miraculous, and there is an element to which, yes, I suppose it was. I mean, I was saved by an avalanche, which is not normally the message. Normally, it's the opposite.
Yes,
I was interviewed the other day by a TV producer. I may be on a mountain rescue program soon. And she said to me that you sound like you were both very unlucky and very lucky. I mean, there's a miracle in one sense. You could say, well, if it was a miracle, why didn't God stop me falling in the first place?
Yeah,
why didn't I have a punch on the way down to stop me getting there? The only thing I can say is, as I was sat there by myself, waiting to be rescued before anyone else got to me, I had this incredible sense of being protected. It struck me at the time. And I just thought, and I feel I am protected here. And I just thought, that's interesting. So I would be very happy to use that word. I'm perfectly happy for other people to use the word miraculous. I'm here. I'm alive. My injuries were minimal compared to what they could have been. And, you know, I'm grateful to God for the opportunity to keep serving him and to carry on doing whatever he wanted to do with my life.
Oh, bless you. Well, thank you so much, Richard. We really appreciate that. And we praise God for his protection at this extraordinary time.
Thank you. Thanks.
So this is Andy Peck. Thank you for joining us. Do check out the podcast online at premierradio.com, iTunes or Podbean. And may God help you as you seek to lead in his name. As we close, the words of the Apostle Paul to the Corinthian church. And God is able to bless you abundantly so that in all things, at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Leadership File on Premier. Andy Peck serves as a tutor at CWR, a Christian charity whose courses and publications aim to apply God's word to everyday life. Contact him via email apeck@cwr.org.uk.